switch to the other?
Same locations.
We're all at, okay, so we're all good for the next case, to call the next case?
She's in Centennial and he's in Polk County.
Thank you. Can I hear first so that we can see and hear from the counsel for appellant, please?
Yes, hi, Sharon Jax here from the State Public Defender's Office.
Thank you. And I just want to make sure I can, we have the other, Mr. Bueller, can you also, again, if it is you arguing this one?
I'm here again, Your Honor.
Okay.
Are you able to hear me?
There. Okay, I want to make sure that we also switch at the voice activation to see you both. So that's good. Thank you. Okay, our case is, the case that we're on now is A18-1122, State of Minnesota versus Juan Andres Gonzalez. And you each have 15 minutes for argument, counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal. And so, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, please again state your name and the party you represent for the record.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. My name is Sharon Jackson. I'm the Assistant State Public Defender representing Juan Gonzalez. Mr. Gonzalez is asking that you reverse his sentences on first-degree drug convictions because they're incorrect both as to disposition and to duration. Pursuant to his plea agreement, Mr. Gonzalez asked for a probationary sentence. He forwarded to the court grounds other than amenability to probation that indicated probation was warranted. But the district court didn't follow the plea agreement or the drug state sentence statute to consider those grounds. Instead, the court simply imposed a prison sentence, indicating in effect that its hands were tied. That's not the case. The statute's very clear that the court can consider grounds other than amenability to probation in determining whether or not a person should be placed on probation. The first ground that Mr. Gonzalez forwarded that was other than amenability to probation was the fact that he had spent the 4 years between the offense date and the sentencing date rehabilitating himself. And this is a really unusual case because we rarely, if ever, see a case where there's a 4 year span between the offense date and the sentencing date where an individual is out in the community under conditions and living their lives, complying and doing well, actually by the time of sentencing, able to demonstrate that they have in fact rehabilitated. He demonstrated that during those 4 years in a number of ways. Upon arrest, at the time he was arrested, initially he immediately cooperated with the police and consented to any searches and as well as giving statements. Within a week, he agreed to act as an informant for the police and help them to apprehend other drug dealers. He addressed his chemical addiction.
So you're saying that these are offender activities as opposed to offense activities, and offender activities can support a departure.
Absolutely. So the broad category that we would list as the factor for a dispositional departure, the mitigating circumstances, is demonstrated reform over a four-year period. That's what the defense attorney argued in his memo to the court. However, the court didn't consider that.
What's our standard of review on that decision by the trial court?
Well, it depends on how you characterize it. I mean, certainly by not considering the factor presented, the court didn't exercise its discretion. And under Curtis and Mendoza, not exercising your discretion is an abuse of discretion. And so a remand would be required to consider that. If you're looking at what is the mitigating circumstance, that's de novo. The court didn't explicitly make a finding that 4 years of reform is not a valid mitigating circumstance. It seemed to feel that it didn't need to go there because the statute wouldn't let him consider it anyhow. But to the extent there's some sort of implicit finding that 4 years of demonstrated reform is or is not a mitigating factor, that would be something this court reviews de novo because that's a question of law.
And is there any case law? So your argument, as I understand it, is that his post-offense rehabilitation was not a sub-factor of amenability to probation. rather is its own independent factor, rehabilitation.
Correct.
Between that. And is there any case law identifying that as a substantial and compelling circumstance?
There's no case law explicitly recognizing that factor. Of course, we have the 152, the drug state sentence statute, as well as the guidelines that say that there are other factors besides amenability to probation that can be factors. We also have State versus Solberg, a Minnesota Supreme Court decision that says that the court can, in offender, as far as offender-related factors, the court can look to anything that shows that the defendant has the ability to reform. And certainly, if ability to reform is a mitigating factor, proof that you have actually reformed to a great extent must be a factor. The reason there's no case law, obviously, is A, very few cases, if any, where a defendant has been out for 4 years before sentencing. But B, you know, no disrespect to the judge here. I think he just misunderstood the statute, but it's hard to imagine a district court reviewing a defendant who has, in fact, reformed, has recovered from their addiction, has not committed any crimes, has cooperated with the police, has gotten a job and has a productive member of society, concluding that that person just can't show that they have an ability to reform because they've actually demonstrated that they have reformed. So that in and of itself would be a factor that the court should have considered. Another factor that the defense brought up was the fact that when you look to other offenders who have committed this offense, for the first time, 50% of them, according to the Guidelines Commission, received dispositional departures. And in State versus Soto, the Minnesota Supreme Court, independent from its analysis on amenability to probation, went on to say that a remand was required because the Guidelines Commission's statistics with respect to that offense indicated that that individual's sentence was disproportionate. And that would be another reason to remand here. At a minimum, the district court should have looked at the fact, which here in this case, the defense counsel did in fact present these statistics at the time of the sentencing hearing. And so it's hard to understand exactly why the court didn't consider them, except that when you read his sentencing decision on page 38 and 39 of the sentencing transcript explaining his earlier order denying the probationary sentence, the court states that it just doesn't believe that the statute allows him to consider those things.
What precisely then is the, so again, this is another factor that you would say is separate and apart from amenability to probation, and that substantial and mitigating circumstances that other, like some substantial number of other defendants in similar circumstances received departures? Is that the factor, the substantial and compelling circumstance?
How the Supreme Court analyzed it in Soto was less explicitly recognizing it as a circumstance, but recognizing it as what Section 244 requires an appellate court to do. Under Section 244, an appellate court has to review a sentence to determine whether or not it is disproportionate or unreasonable. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said in Soto that in addition to it being questionable whether or not the individual was amenable to probation, its review of the Guidelines Commission statistics indicated that it was disproportionate to what other offenders who had committed that crime were receiving, and that was a second basis for remanding to the district court for reconsideration. So again, they did not explicitly say this is a mitigating circumstance. They said we as appellate judges under 244 are required to review a sentence to determine if it's disproportionate, and we are doing that, and we think it is, and so this is another reason we're sending it back.
Irrespective of the presence of a substantial and compelling circumstance, we would have to, an appellate court has to review whether a guideline sentence is disproportionate?
Yeah, that's in section 244. I think it's 02. I don't have the site before me. But it indicates appellate courts review the sentence to determine whether it's excessive, unreasonable, disproportionate. I'd point you to SOTO, and it cites the specific statutory site. It's also in Rule 28, Your Honor. And the under the sentencing, this court's sentencing, you know, appeals, it also indicates that. I would also say that despite remorse being noted as a trog factor, in State versus Solberg, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that is an independent factor. In Solberg, the court and the court did not address that issue head on. The court held that remorse generally is not a factor in determining a downward durational departure. But in so holding, the court compared and contrasted it to remorse in the dispositional departure context. And there the court said that because remorse, not amenability to probation, but remorse, because remorse is something that demonstrates that an offender has a capability of rehabilitation, it is a proper ground to depart dispositionally, to give a probationary sentence. And so all of these facts about Mr. Gonzalez that I've cited that show he had, in fact, reformed over a four-year period also demonstrate that he had remorse for what he did. Had he not been remorseful, he wouldn't have cleaned up his act like he did. He wouldn't have addressed his chemical dependency issues. He wouldn't have remained free of any offenses. He wouldn't have acted as an informant. So that is also remorse in and of itself is an independent ground on which this court or that the district court could have found him to be a proper candidate for probation. But the problem is, of course, is that the court just simply didn't consider any of those things. And so what Mr. Gonzalez is asking for is a remand with direction to the court that the statute didn't preclude him from doing that. In fact, the statute explicitly says that the court can consider any other ground than amenability to probation and place a person on probation. Now, the other problem with Mr. Gonzalez's sentence is the duration, because he was sentenced on the drug sale, and as a result, there was a Hernandez sentence, and his sentence moved up, I think, from 52 months to 78 or something to that effect. He should not have been sentenced on the sale because it occurred during the same behavioral incident as the conspiracy. And the state had the burden of proving that they were some sort of separate acts, the conspiracy and the underlying sale. But
what the defendant... So is this a claim for violation of 609.035?
Correct, correct. And the colloquy here, what the defendant admitted to was a conspiracy on or about July 4th, as well as a sale on or about July 4th. So that is one behavioral incident, and therefore a second sentence on the sale was prohibited. The state is relying on a case, State versus Heath, I believe it is, that indicates that a conspiracy to manufacture methamphetamine and a sale of methamphetamine are separate behavioral incidents. But of course, that's a very different situation because there's an intervening act that has to occur between the conspiracy and the sale. That is the actual manufacture of the meth. So the sale is obviously occurs after the conspiracy because there has to be an agreement and then the creation of the methamphetamine and then the sale.
Does the record reflect that there's any other overt act taken by a conspirator in this case other than the sale that formed a separate conviction?
With respect to what the defendant admitted to in the plea colloquy, no. There is a 9-page complaint that I believe Mr. Gonzalez has not mentioned until page 8, but there's a very long and detailed complaint that sets out what the state believes to be a very involved conspiracy among numerous people that aren't involved in this case. directly. So the state points to that there was some text messages between the defendant, Mr. Gonzalez, and his brother that demonstrated the conspiracy, as well as apparently an explicit agreement, a verbal agreement. But the complaint doesn't indicate that that occurred on a different date than July 7th. And more importantly, it was the state who had the burden by a preponderance of the evidence to show separate behavioral incidents. And a complaint, as we all know, it's long settled, does not reach the preponderance of the evidence quantum of proof. Probable cause is a much lower quantum of proof than is preponderance of the evidence. So because this was a separate behavioral incident, he also asked that sentence be vacated, and as well as this matter being remanded for a consideration on the conspiracy for a probationary sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors and counsel. Again, my name is Scott Bueller. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney. I'm appearing here in Crookston, Minnesota. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal. I would like to start out with the last issue that counsel was just addressing, and that is Minnesota Statute 609.035, because it's my view that her entire argument is based upon a fundamental misunderstanding of the law. In a reply brief, counsel states that appellant relies on the facts he admitted supporting the charges he pleaded guilty to at his plea hearing. But the problem is that at the guilty plea hearing, appellant's counsel specifically asked the district court to, and I quote, adopt the probable cause portion of the complaint into your factual findings. That's at page 50 of the transcript. Page 51, the district court explicitly did so. And as this court has stated in State versus Jackson in 2003, hearsay admitted into evidence without or over objection becomes substantive evidence in trial, relying on a prior Minnesota Supreme Court decision. So the complaint is in the record at the request of appellant's counsel in determining the facts of this case. So counsel's argument that somehow this court is limited only to what the defendant has admitted to is incorrect as a matter of law. I also would note that, cases such as...
Is this an argument that you made in your brief?
No, Your Honor, it's just in picking this up, I didn't realize that in her reply brief, the way she was arguing that she's relying only on the facts that the defendant admitted to. That's what I'm responding to, Your Honor.
Okay, and the complaint you're saying is record evidence that the allegations in the complaint are facts, I guess, that can be considered in determining a single behavior incident because it was admitted at sentencing. Is that?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would note there's also a fundamental flaw with counsel's argument. That is, she argues that the defendant admitted to one sale to one person on one day. If those were the only facts, that would not be a conspiracy offense. And this court has made clear that a buy-seller arrangement, that is, one single sale, would not constitute a conspiracy. The facts of this case are that the defendant and his brother were selling cocaine for a number of months. His brother indicated he'd been selling cocaine for approximately 3 months to others that he was getting from the defendant in this case. The defendant acknowledged he had two sources of cocaine, one in Texas, one in North Dakota, that he was bringing the cocaine into Minnesota, was distributing it to others through his brother. That's what establishes the conspiracy. Those facts go far beyond the single sale that counsel is focusing on.
If we looked at the guilty plea colloquy, is there sufficient, and if one looked only at that and did not rely on the complaint, has the state established by a preponderance of the evidence that these are separate behavioral incidents based only on the guilty plea colloquy?
It'd be difficult to argue that, Your Honor, because based solely upon that guilty plea, I don't believe there's even a factual basis for the defendant's plea of guilty to conspiracy. The argument that one sale on one day to one individual is the equivalent of a conspiracy is the same argument that this court rejected in Pinkerton.
Right. So the guilty plea looks vulnerable based on the colloquy alone, not to mention
if that
the sentence
raised by appellant hasn't raised that
appellant
issue.
Has not
one
raised
reason
it.
I bring that up is that fact that I think everybody who participated in this, myself included, the district court and appellant's counsel, all were expecting the district court to rely upon the probable cause portion of the complaint in providing additional factual support for the guilty plea in this case, and that was done specifically at the instigation of appellant's counsel. So I don't know how counsel can get around the district court considering those facts when it was the appellant's counsel at the district court level who asked the district court to consider the complaint and the facts set forth in it.
And once appellant's counsel did facts, that, I'm sorry, to, but appellant's counsel did that at sentencing or at the guilty plea?
At the guilty plea hearing, Your Honor, at page 50.
At the guilty plea, at page 50. Huh.
This quote was, adopt the probable cause portion of the complaint into your factual findings.
Okay. I don't have that page in front of me. Okay.
But once you acknowledge that the facts go beyond the one sale on one day to one person, I believe that under State versus Heath, State versus Lucio, an unpublished opinion from this court, in fact, I think the facts of this case are almost identical to Lucio, in that this conspiracy expands a several-month time period, that it is not at the same behavioral incident because the conspiracy is completed on the day that the agreement occurred. And in this case, as soon as one overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy occurred in Polk County then had venue, even though there is no overt act requirement under 152.096.
So what would you say since one has to compare to first same behavioral incident, the, you know, the dates and the locations and the objective, right? So in order to do that, what do you say the dates are then for the agreement and the overt act?
Well, the conspiracy offense itself, as charged in count one of the complaint, covered the time period of April 15 of 2014 through July 7 of 2014. But as a matter of law, a conspiracy is completed at any time during that portion when the defendant agreed with another person to sell one or more mixtures of a total weight of 10 grams or more containing cocaine. There is no overt act requirement under 152.096 like there is under the traditional conspiracy statute, but Polk County, of course, would not have venue to charge a conspiracy until such time as an overt act occurred in Polk County. Every sale, every overt act that occurred after that initial overt act in Polk County essentially was a renewal or a continuation of the conspiracy, but it doesn't change the fact that the conspiracy was completed at the time of the agreement. It's exactly what this court said in State versus Heath. And the idea that you can separate Heath out because it was a manufacturer case, conspiracy to manufacture to sale, I don't think holds water, Your Honor, because the statutory definition of sale includes manufacture. You just have to look at the definitional provisions of 152.01 subdivision 15A. Sale and manufacture are included in that same definitional provision. So I believe that on the facts of this case, the conspiracy and the controlled subscribing the first-degree sale offense are separate behavioral incidents, and the district court did properly use the Hernandez method of sentencing, just as in Lucio and in Heath. Now, with regard to 152, the statute in this case, with regard to sentencing and the dispositional departure, the statute sets forth two alternative grounds that a district court can impose a mitigated dispositional departure, either stay execution or imposition of sentence. The first is based upon amendability to probation, but that's only if the defendant has been accepted into and can respond to a treatment program. There's no evidence in the record to support that. In fact, the district court found that was not applicable in this case. The alternative ground is that a mitigated dispositional departure can be based on any other ground, but only if a condition of probation includes incarceration in jail or workhouse. Now, counsel has listed a whole series of what she claims are any other grounds. In fact, in her reply brief, she goes so far as to say that these are independent bases supporting probationary sentences in general. Age, cooperation with police upon being arrested, post-arrest assistance to law enforcement, acceptance of responsibility, strong community character, post-offense rehabilitation, support the community, and sentences of similarly situated offenders. But counsel doesn't cite to any case that supports any of those factors as being a standalone departure factor that would justify a mitigated dispositional departure. And frankly, I think State versus Soto undermines that entire argument that counsel's making. Look at the facts of Soto. The district court relied upon the defendant's age, his minimal record, his remorse, his cooperation through pleading guilty, his attitude in court, and his family support. And the Minnesota Supreme Court referred to those, I think as everybody refers to them, as the trog factors. Those are the factors, the sub-factors that are considered in the ultimate determination as to whether or not a defendant is particularly amenable to probation. But the court specifically stated in Soto, factors that may not be directly considered as reasons for departure occasionally bear indirectly on a determination such as whether a defendant is particularly suitable to treatment in a probationary setting. It went on again and stated, facts that cannot themselves justify a departure can be relevant to determining whether a defendant is particularly amenable to probation. I think the court made it clear. The individual factors here were not standalone factors for departure.
Yeah.
They were sub-factors of amenable to probation.
Mr. Buehler, one of the things, though, it looked like the district court, it was so specific in its order when it denied that motion for mitigation. It really, at least I think a fair reading is, it says this is a statutory hurdle that cannot be overcome, referring to the amenability to probation, you know, unless you could be accepted by a treatment program. It looks like the district court made no consideration under this second prong of that 152 that if there were another ground, you know, and if it included a condition of incarceration in a local jail. So what is your response to that?
First of all, the order was only addressing that first alternative under the statute, that is the amenability to probation.
Right.
With being accepted to treatment, because that's the only ground that had been urged by the defendant at that point in time. And the district court issued that order saying no. Then the defendant came back, his counsel argued that, well, all of these sub-factors are independent grounds. The district court, I don't think he said it explicitly, but I mean implicitly, was saying those are the factors that make up amenable to probation. It did consider the one standalone factor, and that would be whether or not the defendant was a minor or passive participant in the crime. That is an independent departure factor under the guidelines, but the court rightfully found that that did not apply in this case because it was the defendant who was importing cocaine from Texas and North Dakota, was distributing it to his brothers, to others. So he was the most culpable of the individuals that were prosecuted in Polk County.
So can you address, counsel, I appreciate your argument on that, and the oral argument today is a little different, I think, from the brief on it, because there are only then two, maybe three, purported alternative substantial and compelling circumstances, which is that appellant argued that the fact of rehabilitation between the offense and sentencing is a standalone. It's not a sub-factor of amenability to probation. It's a standalone, and mitigating circumstances are not exclusively dictated, you know, under the sentencing guidelines. So the court should have considered that as a standalone mitigating circumstance under the second part of that. What's your response to that?
The problem I have with that argument is twofold. First, counsel cites nothing to support that. Solberg was a downward durational departure case, talking about remorse as it relates back to could in some cases justify a downward durational departure. But when he talked about remorse with regard to dispositional departures, again, it was doing so in the context of the trog factors. But again, go back to Soto. The district court specifically found a number of these, what counsel now claims to be standalone departure factors.
Well, the one that I was focused on. The one I was focused on was not remorse, but the first one that appellant's counsel focused on in the oral argument, which is that there was, in fact, rehabilitation up until now. And that's different from, you know, you are amenable going forward to probation because you can be rehabilitated. There was, in fact, rehabilitation. So address why that should not have been an independent ground separate from amenability to probation.
Because, again, I believe it's tied up into the issue of whether or not an individual is particularly amenable to probation. That post-offense conduct is what courts look at in making that ultimate determination, are you particularly amenable to probation? You know, Soto, the defendant, was actually in treatment at the time that the Minnesota Supreme Court heard the case and concluded, individually and collectively, those factors provide very little support for the further conclusion that Soto had any particularly amenable to probation relative to other defendants. Again, it's that totality of the circumstances. And if, in fact, there is authority in this state that says post-offense rehabilitation by itself is a standalone departure factor, I would have thought that counsel would have been able to cite something to the court.
But isn't that a little bit of a problem for this particular offender? Is that it says, well, amenability to probation only if you have adequate evidence that you've been accepted by and can respond to a treatment program. If the person has already completed treatment and they are, in fact, rehabilitated, that seems to leave them, just by virtue of the timing of this case, sort of leave them in a position that they might not have been in, maybe even if they had been sentenced closer to the offense, because they could have gotten in the treatment program that they apparently then successfully complete.
If those were the facts of this case, I would agree that would make this a more difficult case. The simple fact is that there was no evidence this defendant was ever chemically dependent or did treatment. In fact, when he told the PSI writer He indicated when he was importing cocaine into Polk County and into Minnesota, he only used occasionally every few months. And his only proof that later on, after the judge had denied the motion under the first part of 152-152, he then provided evidence of one positive UA while he was employed, and then a CD assessment later on that said he might have been dependent at some other point in time. But he never did go through any type of treatment. So I don't believe those are the facts of this case. You have here a defendant who's after the fact trying to pigeonhole himself into a statute that he didn't comply with initially. I just want to address the other argument about Soto, and that is counsel leaves out the fact that the Minnesota Supreme Court has never said sentencing statistics by themselves justify a departure. This court has specifically rejected that argument in State versus Perlberg and a number of unpublished opinions that I cited as well. But more importantly, in Soto, the Supreme Court said the most important comparative and most closely analogous case would be that of the co-defendant who ended up with an executed prison sentence. In this case, two of the three co-defendants, less culpable than Mr. Gonzalez, ended up with executed prison sentences. The sentencing statistics that counsel cites says nothing about an individual case and cites to no case involving a defendant similar to this one who received a dispositional sentencing departure. Had counsel cited that those types of individual cases, then maybe her argument would hold, but simply saying in general others have departed doesn't warrant a departure in this case. I see my time is up. If there aren't any further questions, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Both of you, cases submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time frame.
Can I have a rebuttal?
Oh, my apologies. Oh, my gosh. What's wrong with me today? A rebuttal. We do want to hear from you on rebuttal. Thank you, Judge Paul Brooks.
Thank you. I'd like to point out that all the cases that the state cited indicating you can't consider statistics were all decided pre-Soto, where the Minnesota Supreme Court made very clear that, in fact, you can't consider those. The state's argument about how to read 152-152 really turns the statute on its head. Under its interpretation of that statute, the legislature intended to discourage individuals from reforming themselves or rehabilitating or addressing their chemical dependency issues pre-sentencing, because if they do, they're never going to get onto probation. And of course, that's not what the legislature intended. The legislature intended to permit individuals who could show that they were capable of reform, as the Minnesota Supreme Court said in State versus Solberg, that they would be eligible to be placed on probation because they're the type of people we want on probation.
Right. I don't know that it really would discourage them from starting treatment. It's just that it's the odd circumstance that there'd be enough time that you could fully rehabilitate. I mean, that's like not the usual, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And here, can you respond to the argument that really wasn't, I mean, that there isn't evidence that he reformed through chemical dependency treatment? Did he have chemical dependency treatment?
The record doesn't indicate he went to treatment. The record indicates that he did use cocaine at the time of the offense, and that by the time of sentencing, they had done a 12-month analysis of him having all clean UAs. So to whatever extent he had a chemical dependency problem or a chemical problem, that was dealt with by the time of sentencing. As far as other independent grounds, both Solberg and State versus Run, Minnesota Supreme Court decisions, list trog factors as independent grounds. Now, again, we are relying on his reform, but we are also relying on remorse and the fact that he did not commit any offenses in between the offense and sentencing. Those aren't trog factors. But even under Solberg and Rund, issues like age, remorse, amenability to treatment are independent offender-related grounds that the district courts can rely on in giving a probationary sentence. As for the same behavioral incident issue, on page 50 or 51 of the plea transcript, it does indicate that for purposes of the colloquy that the court is admitting complaint to make it part of the record. But the case law is clear that facts in a guilty plea proceeding that the defendant explicitly negates I believe that's State versus Iverson. Those facts can't be used in determining an individual's guilt, and similarly, that they shouldn't be used in determining whether two offenses are part of the same behavioral incident or not.
But that latter point that you just made about the same behavioral incident, is there a case on that? Or is the case that, did the case that you cite deal with factual basis of a plea?
Factual basis. There are no cases on using the complaint in the same behavioral incident context, honestly. And as I pointed out, part of that may be because the state's burden for proving a separate behavioral incident is preponderance of the evidence, and probable cause is proved by a quantum of proof much lower than preponderance of the evidence. So even if the court adopted the complaint in full, that doesn't prove by a preponderance of the evidence anything. It's a complaint.
What was happening on page 51 with that then? I mean, what does that mean to be admitted?
Yeah, that wasn't part of the sentencing. That was part of the plea colloquy.
Exactly.
And the it was not the defense. It was the prosecutor who just said at the very end of the plea hearing, we asked that the complaint be made part of the record. And then the judge said, I'm making the complaint part of the record. It did not indicate for what purpose it was making the complaint part of the record. Perhaps it was to buttress the plea because, as the prosecutor pointed out here, it was, a little bit light on facts, but the court ultimately accepted it, and it's our position that the colloquy, even if you consider the complaint, does not prove by a preponderance of the evidence that these were separate behavioral incidents, so he should have only one sentence. If the court has no further questions, we'd ask that you reverse and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. Now thank you both, and the case is
thank
submitted.
You.
And we are in recess.